As climate change continues to loom and humanity becomes progressively more aware of the consequences of the quality of our surroundings, urban development challenges have prompted decision makers to take environmental issues into account when reconfiguring city spaces. The United Nations estimates that almost 70% of the world's population will be living in urban areas by 2050, which has prompted inclusion in the UN Agenda 2030 Sustainable Development Goals. Goal number 11 aims to make cities and human settlements inclusive, safe, resilient, and sustainable. Making cities more green has taken into account also at the European level. One example of this is the annual European Green Capital Award, given by the European Commission to a city which is a pioneer in environmental activities, acts as an example for other cities, and/or develops innovative solutions to environmental challenge. This year, the European Green Capital is Tallinn, Estonia. Hello, my name is Terry McDonald, and this is the Tallinn University Podcast. So, welcome to our annual Green Month episode of the Tallinn University Podcast. Today we're going to talk about green cities, and we're joined by an expert in the field, Bianca Pluszka-Altoff. She's a senior researcher in environmental sociology here at Tallinn University. Hope you enjoy our conversation. Okay, we're here with Dr. Bianca Pluszka-Altoff. Welcome to the Tallinn University Podcast.
Hello.
So, if you could tell us first off, what makes a city green and why is that desirable?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So, this is always how these kind of interviews start, and I think it's one of the hardest questions to answer, actually, what makes a city green?
Because, sorry to be so typical, yeah.
No, because there are so many different interpretations of green, and I think this is also what makes the whole green city debate very tricky. You could understand green in the sense of sustainable city planning for reduced CO2 emissions. Then you would really maybe much more go into climate neutrality and energy efficiency. But you could also understand green like in a more literal sense, like of a city that is actually literally green, has a lot of urban nature, for example. And the different understandings of green, they are often or they might also contradict one another, and which is one of the challenges when we talk about green city topics. For example, from spatial planning, there is a huge trend towards densification of cities, which would actually mean that you place the new housing more in the city center, so people would not have to travel so far anymore, which would actually reduce CO2 emissions on one hand. On the other hand, this quite often happens on the account of green spaces in the city center. So this is where they come into to contradict one another and might play against each other, and where we have the strong need actually for balancing it out. And I think this is what for me would ideally mean to have a green city, is to really have this emphasis on kind of balancing out different aspects of sustainability, economic, social, and environmental ones. And you know, thereby thinking, of course, also about future generations, but really to outweigh them with another, and to also think in terms of in terms of questions of justice, which is very much important also for our research, to really think whom does this impact and in which way, whatever decisions we are making, whatever translations we are making. I think the
so there are intersectional aspects of the
yes,
green understanding?
For example. And the second aspect that you were asking about was the kind of why should we do that? Why should we invest our time and resources in that? And here I would now refer to the still ongoing urbanization trend, even though, you know, in COVID times there was some kind of a counter trend to what's going to the countryside, but still the urbanization continues, while at the same time also the climate and environmental crisis is deepening. And there, then cities become kind of, you know, as really focal multiple points. On the one hand, for maybe deepening the crisis, but also being very vulnerable, vulnerable to the impacts of the crisis, for example, for heat waves, flooding, and so on. And if we want to actually adapt to climate change, then the using green city strategies is one way of doing it. And for me, with our focus on really green spaces, you know, there you would have a lot of arguments actually for keeping as much green as you possibly can, to have rainwater infiltration, to have cooling effects in the summer and so on, which is not only relevant for the nature itself, but also for us as people living in the city.
So on that, can you give us some like specific approaches to green urbanization?
Well, as I said, for example, densification is actually one approach to it, depending on the different understandings of green, right? Yeah, yeah. So if we talk about green spaces, then later approaches would be more related to anything that is connected to climate change adaptation. Also, you know, that making the parks, for example, more adaptable to rainy water. In Sweden, we have seen, for example, rain parks, which would on one hand help to avoid flooding, but also, you know, make the parks usable, or again, also in situations where we have a lot of rain, for example, because in the northern hemisphere, it can actually climate change might not actually mean that we only have sunny, a lot more sunny days. Then we have the trend toward kind of more nature-based solutions inspired by nature throughout the whole city grid. And the trend towards a kind of more creation together with co-creation together with the residents to actually account for the needs, not only technological needs that we might have in climate change or in the era of climate change, but also for the needs of local residents and how exactly they need and want to use green spaces and the city itself.
So in your research, have you come across any good examples of what you consider a successful green city?
Mm-hmm. Once again, also this depends on how you define what would be green. But there are initiatives, for example, in especially also in the Scandinavian countries, in London, for example, in Barcelona, deliberately set the objective of, for example, increasing the tree canopy. This sounds like a small thing, but it actually has. It's worth mentioning because quite often, also if we have a new planning projects, even for increasing sustainability and resilience, kind of often it leads to a loss of green spaces and of tree canopy. So to set this up as an objective itself is already worth mentioning. And then, of course, we have a lot of cities which are doing also larger scale green interventions. Some of them also very well known, like starting, for example, with the kind of Highline projects in some American or US American cities. We also have linear parks here, for example, in Tallinn, the pollinator highway. But all of these initiatives, I always say in a way that the devil lies in the details. So objectives and the great visions and ideas are one thing, but what actually happens then in the implementation, how this impacts people living in the city is already another question. Recent research actually has shown that we can actually in some ways speak of called a tyranny of small decisions when we are trying to implement these objectives, that even if it is set as an objective to keep urban nature, for example, or tree canopy, then quite often if you think of a city as a small kind of projects which have to be where there have to be procurement procedures, we have to be decided at a certain level, then kind of often when ballots take out several aspects, for example, buying building a new tram line versus keeping old trees, then quite kind of often the decision actually will end up in some loss of urban greenery. So
for our non-Estonian viewers,
which might count, Estonia. So
for our non-Estonian listeners, that is a very hot button topic in Estonia right now. There's 3 100-year-old trees cut down for a new tram line very recently. Correct?
Yes, exactly. And this is this is a case that we have in Tallinn, but that we also have in a lot of other cities. So it's really like going on the small scale of actually implementing the project. They're kind of often is where things happen, even in the most forerunners of sustainability, like for example also in northern countries like in Sweden and in Finland. And the same goes for larger scale green intervention projects, which have also shown the effect after implementation or during implementation to raise, for example, housing prices close to these areas, which might actually mean if we think of the perspective from people living in the city, that those who might need it most, urban greenery, because they might not have access to summer houses, might not go on a holiday so easily and so on, might be more dependent on public space, that kind of often for them it means that they will not be able to afford living close to these projects, or were able to do it before and are not able to do it after, and which would know under green gentrification. So it's very tricky, actually, when getting into the details.
And for those interested in pollination corridors, like you were mentioning, you can check out our season 1 episode, Why Bees Matter. So you and your colleagues have recently published a book called Whose Green City? Contested Urban Green Spaces and Environmental Justice in Northern Europe. Can you tell us what are some of the central lessons from your research?
Thank you for the question. I'm always very, very happy to talk about this, what I kind of a little bit call like my Corona baby, because during the pandemic, I was sitting a lot at home and editing this book. What might be the specifics of this book, which came out last year, is that we are kind of shifting the focus a little bit. When usually you have a look at contested urban green spaces and questions of environmental justice, then quite often this happens in very kind of extreme cases of neglected inner cities, for example. But we had a look at them in the context of Northern Europe, which would also include, for example, the Scandinavian countries, which are often actually seen as kind of forerunners of sustainability. So it also included Estonia and Latvia as kind of post-socialist countries, and also post-socialist countries, if we have a look typical criteria to evaluate if a city is green or not in terms of urban greenery, then also post-socialist countries actually and cities count as very green, because they usually fulfill the quantitative criteria of having a high provision in green space and of having following up this famous 300 meter criteria, which means that your nearest green space should be 300 meters walking distance from your home. And in Tallinn, for example, I think it's for more than 80% or something of the city residents actually live close by to some kind of green space in 300 meter distance. So looking at it from kind of bird perspective, the Scandinavian countries, but also the post-socialist countries that we and cities that we included, you might think that everything is okay. What kind of environmental justice questions are there to ask? And this actually, as I always was telling, is kind of we actually use this as a research opportunity to really dive deep, to really have a look at what happens in the implementation of certain projects. What is the precise, everyday experience of vulnerable groups in these cities? And thereby we could actually, uncover aspects that might be overlooked if you follow this bird perspective criteria and the quantitative criteria. And one of these were, for example, the understanding of accessibility to green spaces, which is very central, and which often is only studied in like literally like how close is the green space and what kind of street cover do we have, can we walk there or not, also with walking inabilities. But actually that accessibility has to work like the whole way from door to door, from home to home, which includes also all the elevators and public transport, all the way that other people treat you if you have walking disabilities, the information that is available beforehand and so on. We could pinpoint to trends, for example, in the UK, in one case of green commodification, which means that in an area trend towards more like not a trend but actually in a real existing neoliberal urban governance systems, which is where UK is a good example of, you have the incentive to actually self-finance also the city districts and also the green spaces. And what happened in London, for example, is that the green spaces, you know, actually have to be funded somehow, the maintenance, for example. And what they're doing is to rent them out for festivals, which might seem as a good thing, actually, because you might get other user groups there who usually don't maybe go to parks. They can self-finance. But looking at it in detail actually showed that this renting out the green spaces actually had gone totally out of balance, closing it up for non-paying users for most of the high seasons of green space use from spring to early autumn. And thereby, once again, also raising questions of justice and who can afford a ticket and who doesn't. And so we really, really try to dive deep and really raise these kind of questions which would not be visible at the first place, but still influence the very subjective experience of the city residents to a huge extent.
Well, you raised a couple of interesting issues there. Can you talk about how the transition from, say, socialist cities to neoliberal models has affected greening of these cities?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think here socialist cities are, or post-socialist cities are, a very intriguing example, because, as I said, they are kind of, you know, on the surface kind of giving a lot of opportunities to be in and with urban nature. And how it is affected by now is, we have one article, for example, which has a look at urban gardening as one case, and there are different mechanisms of neoliberal urban governance that have led in the case of Tallinn, for example, to the preference of one urban gardening form over another. In this case, of community gardening over allotment gardening and dacha gardening, and the reasons for this is, for example, that if we go back to kind of pillars of neoliberal liberalism, and one would then be kind of this entrepreneurialism and a kind of a profit orientation, that even though green spaces per se do not generate profit, but one important aspect is kind of the competition between cities, and cities being possibly marketable to certain audiences and groups. And the community gardens have actually helped a lot to market Tallinn as a green city by being very visible in social media, by doing a lot of events. This, they have not necessarily done that to promote Tallinn, but more also to promote community gardening. But this was one of the reasons why they were supported to such a large extent, something that most of the dacha gardening communities have not seen as necessary for them, and which has, you know, then kind of, you know, rendered them invisible in a way, even though if we talk about sustainability, just in terms of their sheer size, they could actually have a larger impact even on sustainable city planning than the community gardens, just because of taking up more space and giving more opportunities for increasing biodiversity, for example.
The inspiration for our episode today was Tallinn was awarded the European Green Capital title for 2023. Can you tell us more about this competition, this label?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I definitely can, but I would just like to mention in advance that I have not studied that in depth. Yeah,
I'm sure you know more about it than I do.
But well, the European Green Capital Award actually originally was, let's say so, invented in Tallinn. Maybe this is something that is worthwhile already about 15 years ago, I think in 2006, starting the competition, and it's now very much aligned to the European Union's aim of becoming climate neutral and to the European Union Green Deal and of cities kind of, you know, as pioneer for climate change adaption and for kind of new sustainable era. There's actually also a sister award, which is the European Green Leaf Award for smaller cities. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah, as you pointed out, Tallinn now has received the title for 2023. It has already applied several times before that, not successfully, and has incrementally then improved its application. However, as you have already kind of a little bit indicated, of course, here on like in Tallinn itself, there are also a lot of discussions if this award was received, if receiving the award was justified, or what would then still be areas of improvement.
Definitely my next question. So, does Tallinn deserve the award?
For me, this is a difficult question to answer, to be honest.
Does anyone deserve anything? Yeah.
Because, as you know, academics are usually like kind of typical academic answer would be it depends. And once again, coming back to that, I think they are like pro and counter arguments. What they have received it for actually was one thing also related, for example, to my area of research of urban greenery and urban green spaces. As I said, similar to other post-socialist city, there is a lot of greenery, and there have also been a lot of recent investments into the urban green infrastructure. Talking about like this more newer projects of, for example, the Pollinator Highway, but also the whole community gardening initiative was actually very much supported and co-funded also by the city of Tallinn. Of course, the one other criteria was also related, for example, to the free public transport in Tallinn and to ambitions for like long-term strategies to become climate neutral and to really like develop, for example, a city that would be more walkable. Where you would be able to reach your destinations in 15 minutes with either public transport or by light traffic roads. So there was a lot of ambition in this application, definitely. But of course, my colleagues have also been rightfully pointing out that if we once again look into the details, there is still a lot to do. And I think the main area of critique would really be the question of the transport organization in Tallinn and how much sustainable or non-sustainable it is, because in Estonia in general, as also the 2020 Estonian Human Development Report has actually pointed out, is very much car-centered in Estonia in general and also in Tallinn. So it really, I wouldn't say encourage, but it really makes car driving very easy, and due to the reason that the alternatives are not well enough developed, even though if public transport is free. Mm-hmm. And for me, originally moving here from Berlin, I was thinking that I'm kind of moving towards the future.
I was going to say, coming from North America, you think this is car-centric. Yeah.
So free public transport, and for me it was very difficult to grasp all the critiques about it. But living here personally, you know, the kind of the way that the public transport grid is developed, it's not really attuned to the needs or to the everyday trajectories that people have at the moment.
Okay.
So it thereby travel distances become very long, for example, and this makes it very easy to choose the car instead. Okay. And I think there's a lot of room for improvement. The second room for improvement would definitely be walkability. You have also probably lived through an Estonian winter in Tallinn, so walkability might be very tricky. And this is again also more of a problem even for vulnerable groups. And this is also a question of prioritization. Of course, you need to also have the main streets clean, but you know that some sidewalks do not get cleaned from snow and ice at all. it's already another question, and there are like several of these areas that could be improved. But I actually also think that the Green Capital Award might also be this has actually been also shown in our studies. This might also be setting an incentive. Or being kind of a good card that you can play if you want to lobby for more sustainable city planning. Okay. And this is also actively done and used.
In one of our episodes last season, we discussed the issue of greenwashing. Mm-hmm. Is greenwashing, is there an element of risk that we might be engaging in greenwashing with some of the Green Cities movement?
Definitely. I would say that wherever you kind of have a market, there you also have the risk of greenwashing. This is not only true for the private sector, but very much also for the public sector and for sustainable city projects. And as you have a market, as I said before, like cities in a kind of way, if they conceive themselves as being in competition to other cities for employees, for residents, and so on, for investors, being green is definitely more and more becoming an argument to win over. And therefore, there's also a lot of engagement actually in green marketing. And wherever you have green marketing, it's a very thin line how much the kind of image that you are portraying and the real actions that you are doing, how much and how close they are aligned to one another, and how much maybe also in terms of reactions, small green interventions, as for example pocket parks, or how much they're actually contributing to the whole idea of a green city, or if they are really like just making it look more green. So there are a lot of there are a lot of tones of gray in between, and I think this is also something that definitely Tallinn needs to be aware of. But I have the feeling also that the residents are constantly reminding the city of Tallinn of these risks. In general, I would say that there are also positive aspects to green marketing, because we have been also, as scientists working in this field, we have been advocating for such a long time to take into account ecological and climate change crisis that we are heading towards, to really move towards more sustainable solutions. And actually, in a way, then could also be we could also see it as something welcoming, because it sets it offers like discursive room to discuss these ideas for the first time. When before that, for example, especially in a country, in a transformation country as Estonia used to be, you would kind of often hear, if you bring environmental arguments, you would often hear that there are other more urgent concerns. People have to, see that economically they are well off, and we have to solve social problems. Definitely, this is all true. But it's good that through all these initiatives, there has been now discursive space opened to discuss this, and that they can not be dismissed anymore so easily.
Estonia, pretty much everywhere in the world, has been experiencing urbanization, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. How about the cities other than Tallinn in Estonia? Have they been making any progress towards green city movements?
Actually, in terms of urbanization, yeah, Estonia is also pretty extreme case, because we can actually really think, really talk of kind of in the form of a metropolization, because there's a lot of Tallinn as the central focal point. With on the other hand, the peripheralization of the Estonian countryside, which also creates a lot of challenges for regional and urban planning. Yes, and regarding your question, there also other cities have been moving towards this direction. I would say that Tartu, for example, with some initiatives, they even started ahead of Tallinn. Might also be easier to implement due to the smaller size. For example, for the first community and allotment garden initiatives were definitely seen in Tartu. We also have a really interesting project right now seeing it in Tartu, which would be curated biodiversity, where it is very much about shifting the idea also in people's mind of how green spaces in the city should look like, because we are kind of also used to an aesthetics of having like more lawns than actual biodiverse parks, and they are really trying together with the people to also change these cultural norms, which I think is a very intriguing project. And in other cities, I know, for example, that Narva is really much working on the question of how to reuse the courtyards in the socialist districts, where usually they would have the panel houses surrounding the courtyards, okay. Which were initially meant to be recreational areas for the people living in these panel houses, and due to the intense in car mobility, have been more and more used actually as parking lots, and there are like in Narva, but also in other cities now, the initiatives to really rethink these courtyards once again as green spaces for people and for humans and for non-humans, to say so, and to make them less parking spaces and more actual parks again. So there are initiatives heading in towards this direction in other cities as well. Yes.
One of the trends we've been seeing, of course, is a movement also towards smart cities. Mm-hmm. Is the movement towards smart cities and movement toward green cities, are these goals compatible? Sorry to spring that on you.
Yeah, but, no. I actually think it's a very intriguing question, because this both green and smart. Our next research project is actually on smart villages, and both of these actually, in a way, function as what we call floating signifiers. That means that these are kind of terms that you use, but which do not have really an agreed upon meaning. As I said, with green, and the same is also true for smart, and. Initially, they were very much so aligned with one another, connected by the idea of sustainability. Right now, the way that smart is filled with meaning is very much technology and based and market solution based, which kind of often makes it seem as less connected to the idea of green cities, or more connected to an idea of green that would be on reducing CO2 emissions and really much on technology based. Even though I would argue that there's a lot of potential to think both of these together, and that smart doesn't necessarily have to be technological. I think one of the greatest challenges actually could be to also starting, for example, with the idea of circular economy, to really use the resources that we have better.
Okay.
Without necessarily having to invest new resources to create technologies. This is one part of it, but another part should definitely also be to smartly use what we already have. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll let you get out of here on a more general question. How can private citizens contribute to green city movement? How can they advocate for it?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think actually the idea of participation of city residents is very central, and it's also something that has been receiving most of the critiques, because it's very difficult also involve citizens to the degree that might be necessary. One thing could be like there is also participation just for the sake of participation. I have to do. I'm doing it because I have to, as a kind of city official. But it's also tricky sometimes to reach vulnerable groups to really feel. Make them feel that they have a voice that actually counts, and what they are saying will actually be implemented into the decisions. So this is one side of it. Really thinking, or like of the answer to your question is how much citizens really want to be involved and feel that they could be involved and feel that this is something connected to their everyday life. And for those, you know, who are already very much invested, we have seen a few strategies also, for example, in our book of, you know, starting from like kind of really juridical appeal for the case of renting out the park, for example, in the UK, but also more creative forms of artivism, where you would connect like activism and arts to portray new ideas of what green can mean, not only in terms of numbers, of 300 meter criteria and so on, but really in terms of what is our experience, what it means to us as human beings. And one idea, one strategy that has seemed to be has proven to be very beneficial is to really like learn the discourse of those whom you want to reach. So if you notice that a lot of decisions are made based on numerical criteria, for example, kind of including a certain kind of knowledge and a certain kind of idea of green spaces, or a certain idea of green, then a lot of advocate groups have actually, you know, learned to use the same language. But this, of course, sets a lot of thresholds for not everybody is willing and able to do that. But this has proven to be quite a successful strategy, actually.
And just getting people not to cut down their flowers in the spring and things like that, right? Bianca, thank you so much for joining us. Yeah. The book is Whose Green City? Contested Urban Green Spaces and Environmental Justice in Northern Europe. Bianca, thanks so much. Hopefully we'll have you again soon.
Yeah, thank you.
So, thank you for checking out our annual Green episode. As always, we've been brought to you by the Baltic Film, Media and Arts School here at Tallinn University and the School of Governance, Law and Society. For more information about our programs, you can check out www.tlu.ee. Applications are open now. This season, we'd like to celebrate working with Estonian World magazine. They share our passion for English language stories about Estonia's role in the world. You can check them out on Facebook or at www.estonianworld.com. As always, our producer is Alvo Ulvik. Further research and development has been done by Jana Levitinia, Mal Keshmiri, Peter Nikonen, Cynthia Enemosa, Chongbin Lee, Nur Iliana, Eva Dayachuk, Tanding Kang, and Katrin Helen Kasavandik. Our theme song is Ghosts of 68, performed by myself and Paul Simmons. All other music is written and performed by me and maybe Avo. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at TLU Podcast and on Twitter at Tallinn Podcast. So thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with our next episode in a couple of weeks. See you next time.